dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to remember those who have transgressed against the great spirit of inclusion and must henceforth be forever cast into the abyss of dead names. In this moment of our remembrance, we prove with great grief and wailing the sincerity of our noble tolerance. What we once wrongly allowed in the ignorance of white privilege has become the cleansing rite of virtue signaling we use to prove our purity. Join with me now as we remember those we've lost. First, Swastika Mountain in Oregon, which is soon likely to be renamed as something less outrageous, such as Umpqua Mountain or Mount Halo. And even though these are good names, we do think there are some even better candidates, such as Mount Rainbow, Mount Unity, or perhaps Mount Free Speech, which seems fitting for right naming a mountain. Now look, you would think this would be a pretty obvious one, as removing the name of the Nazi symbol from an American Geographic feature seems uncontroversial. However, some have noted that the name actually predated the Nazis by around 30 years and came from the local town of Swastika, which was named for the livestock brand used by a farmer, meaning it has no historical connection to the Nazis. But how can that be relevant? As Lebenhaus' treatise on the effective rewriting of history teaches us, the point is not what actually happened in history. The point is to not offend the feelings of those who do not know what actually happened in history. We rewrite for the wounded, ignorant few, not for the unoffended, knowledgeable many. Some have also noted that the swastika more generally has been around for over 5,000 years and is revered as a sacred symbol of peace by around 2 billion Buddhists, Hindus, and Jains. Now, even if this is true, it also misses the point. As we have repeatedly instructed you, the goal of our order is to always be changing the language and icons so that we can constantly prove our virtue through our rejection of the past. Our holy credo of rejectionism is our means of salvation. Therefore, even when words or symbols really shouldn't be rejected, we reject them anyway, because the holy sacrament of rejecting is the means of our sanctification. Woe unto all who offend.
Woe unto all who offend.
Second, let us take a moment to praise the wonderful work being done at an Australian nightclub to really bow down and worship at the holy altar of personal preference. Club 77, an establishment of drinking and mingling in Sydney, recently announced a policy that bans patrons from staring at anyone who has not given consent to be stared at. In fact, they will have a designated safety officer wearing a pink vest roaming the club to be sure no one is eyeball violating anyone else without their permission. Just think of the honor this policy forces those horrible oglers to give to the would-be victims of their eye molesting. As everyone knows, looking is touching with your eyes. And if even one person is unsafe from the violence of unwanted eye touches, everyone is unsafe. Now, obviously, your right to look at me ends where my right to not be looked at begins. And since my right to not be looked at is absolute, you have no right to use your eyes unless I first give it to you, in writing, with witnesses, and a notary public wearing a bright pink vest to certify the consent. If you seek permission to make eye contact with a stranger in a dark dance hall, it's simple. Just shuffle carefully over to that person, eyes pointed respectfully at your own shoes, and ask, in a very meek voice, if it might be acceptable for you to briefly glance at them in order to decide whether to escalate the interaction to perhaps a nod, or a smile, or, assuming you get permission twice, a wink. Can you not feel the honor and respect in that protocol? Only when nightclub patrons everywhere have fully abandoned the horror of sight assaults can anyone be free to dance like no one else is watching all over again. Woe unto all who offend.
Woe unto all who offend.
And finally, another note of praise for the fine educators at the University of Maryland, Baltimore, who say they only want to hire writing consultants who have a proven track record of, quote, anti-racist activism on their resumes. Yes, one of the preferred qualifications for the job of providing feedback to students on course assignments and helping them write cover letters, grant applications, and other writing assignments is to be a warrior for justice, presumably in addition to being able to write well. As the university says, students will learn writing at the same time as they are being taught language justice theory and how to challenge racializing language ideologies for themselves. Well done, UMB, well done. After all, how can someone be expected to succeed through written communication if all they do is to use words properly without simultaneously seeing the oppression of traditional grammar, the white supremacy embedded in the basic structure of the English language, and the Hegelian power dynamics of the spelling conventions of Western civilization? And don't even get me started on the third degree misogyny of traditional sentence diagramming. Good Gaia, people. If an applicant to be a writing consultant can't explain, and I take these words directly from the job description, how equity, diversity, inclusion, and belonging relate to your academic research, creative activity, and or service experience, how can they possibly be fit to help a struggling student write 5-paragraph essays properly? Woe unto all who offend.
Woe unto all who offend.
And now, with these cleansing rites performed, may we all go forth in loving tolerance and microaggress no more. Woe unto all who offend.
Woe unto all who offend.